Welcome to episode 99 of the Hunt Backcountry podcast. Normally I have a scripted intro that I read saying that this podcast is brought to you by XO Mountain Gear and what it's about. And in that intro I say that there's no fluff and no BS in the show, which is true. But I will make a disclaimer, there's a little bit more BS in this show simply because there's so much fun, so many stories, and so many guys on the line at once. We have the entire Pure Elevation crew, Steve and Lenny and Jason and Tyler, and a bunch of the guys from the Born and Raised Outdoors crew as well. And they join us to recap their Colorado elk hunt. So if you guys caught episode 95, we talked about this project that the Born and Raised guys are doing. It was a 45-day, five-state elk hunt. And the Born and Raised guys and the Pure Elevation guys hunted Colorado together. And that's what we debrief in this episode. So there's a lot to learn for sure, some great insights, but also just a ton of stinking fun as you heard those laughs roll before the music hit on this one. So we're going to get it straight into this one in just a second, but before we do, wanted to give a shout out to Clark from Arkansas for leaving us a review. He went on his first elk hunt in Colorado this year and said that the podcast was helpful for him. So Clark, thank you for the feedback. Listeners, if you want to enter into these weekly giveaways, just leave a review on iTunes or wherever else you might be listening to this, or contact us to podcast@xomountaingear.com by email. And speaking of giveaways, don't forget, next episode, number 100, we have some awesome stuff coming. I hope you guys are looking forward to it. All right, let's get into the show with the Born and Raised and Pure Elevation guys. It's a long one. It's a fun one. It's a crazy one. At times, the audio is a little bit sketchy since we were trying to, you know, push like eight guys through the system. It was not always perfect, but is so much fun. All right, let's get straight into it. We're going live with this crazy crew. I don't even know who's on the line at this point, so let's do this. Let's go through the Pure Elevation guys. Steve, kick off a roll call for you guys, and then we'll get to the rest of the crew.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm here with Lenny and Jason, and then we got Crockett calling in remotely off the cell phone.
Crockett's in the mountains.
Crockett's in the mountains.
Here we are.
He's always in the mountains.
Awesome. Cody, roll through everybody you guys have on your end as well.
So, Cody, Born and Raised, sitting here to my left, we have none other than...
This is Trevor Fisher.
Wow.
Sorry, my mouth was full.
Heck of an entrance.
I'm multitasking.
And this is Trent.
And Steve.
Awesome. So we got the whole crew together, going to recap the Colorado elk hunt. I kind of told Steve going into this, you know, normally I try and have an agenda, which A, I know I can't keep you guys to an agenda, but B, you know, we want to hear about the trip, and I wasn't there. So I'm, you know, in many ways going to sit back and be a listener on this one. I've heard some ridiculous stories already. And I'm sure we'll get into good and bad aspects of hunting as well as just a bunch of ruckus. So I have no idea where this is going to take us. But just to get things started, one question, I guess. Let's start with the Pure Elevation guys. You kind of hinted at it, but what was your thoughts of hunting Colorado for the first time? So that's a wide open question, but just love to kind of start there. What was the experience? Let's start with you, Jason.
I was apprehensive, of course, because it means giving up our Idaho hunts, which were pretty selfish and stingy. But, you know, there's the appeal of there's big bulls in Colorado, or at least big bulls in this area. And it was just cool to hunt with other guys. And we're always so businesslike, and sometimes we don't have as much fun as we probably should. And that was completely different with the Born and Raised crew. It was more about the good time than it was about the hunting sometimes. But it was great. It was a great experience for sure.
Yeah. What was your thoughts, Lenny, on hunting Colorado for the first time?
Yeah, I mean, some of the same. I mean, the only reason we went there, honestly, was to hunt with the Born and Raised guys. and it was totally worth it. I mean, we had such a ball, learned a ridiculous amount. I mean, I learned more in like 7 days than I did in the last, you know, 5-10 years hunting with somebody who just had a completely different experience of hunting elk, you know, than how we hunt them here in Idaho. So it was great. I'd do it again.
Yeah. What were some of those differences that stood out?
You know, honestly, you know, we talked about it a little bit in the hunt. It's just we've all adapted to what we have in front of us. So here in Idaho, you know, I mean, really, we've adapted to we find elk that aren't bothered, and you know, and we can hike and get away from them and get into like large numbers and then find a dumb one.
not get away from the elk. Yeah.
You know, and you know, frankly, we're pretty successful doing that, you know, and those guys, after hearing about how they have to hunt Roosevelt's, I think I would have stayed home and drank beer. I mean, they were like 7 days out here in a bugle, man. It's like, you know, we laughed about it. It's like they hear one bugle, it's like a dog with a bone, man. They do not give up. And, you know, it was a completely different way of hunting for us, but we learned a ton. It was a blast.
Yeah. Or this is to the born and raised guys. Are Roosevelt's generally quiet like that? Or is it just the area you hunt? I'm not familiar with Roosevelt's and their particular behaviors.
I mean, everybody says Roosevelt's don't bugle. That's totally, totally untrue. But I think we're used to versus like you guys that hunt Rocky Mountain bulls, we hear a bugle. And like a Roosevelt, if we can get him to bugle, we've got a pretty darn good chance at least seeing him, if not killing him. And so, but you guys hear these bugles usually all day long, and they're just sounding off, and they're not saying much other than I'm over here or I'm over there. And so I think we just kind of, our minds flip into this whole, like when a Roosevelt bugles, he's mad usually. And it's a whole different type of scenario. And so we take that scenario to every single bugle that we hear when we're in Rocky Mountain country. And we like, well, you guys saw us. I mean, we'll just chase them for 2 miles until they finally stop and get mad and turn around. Whereas I think, you know, a lot of people would have went, well, he's walking away, you know, kind of thing. So, yeah, it's a little different. I think it's just a little different mind frame and hunting altogether. But yeah, that's what we have had out of our playbook from, you know, from hunting Roosevelt.
And the terrain's so much different, too, is yeah. – Just as far as hearing them, it's harder to hear them just because it's so thick and so broke up. It's not like a big main ridge. It's got a bunch of finger ridges and the sound travels. So when we do hear one, generally we're pretty a lot closer than we are to a Rocky, and we're just going to chase them down.
And we don't have the satellite bulls like with the Rocky herds.
Right. So yeah, that's true too.
A bull's usually got his cows. That's a herd bull, whether it's a 4-point or a 5-point. And
yeah.
So we go after that bull.
That's interesting. They just don't have that dynamic where you have a satellite floating around. They'll kind of break off on their own and get their own cows.
Not a lot.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, they will. Don't get us wrong. They will sometimes have a small 3 or 4 point, you know, hanging around and stuff. But majority of the time, it's usually about a bull, and the max number of cows is probably 10.
Yeah.
More along the lines of maybe 4 cows usually, yep. And with just one herd bull.
It's mainly for you guys, just population density. I mean, just not that many elk where you guys hunt.
No, I mean, I wouldn't say that it's not necessarily the population density, but I think it's the terrain dictates. Like you just, it's so broke up. I mean, you could, in a square mile, you could have multiple herds, but just you in that square mile, you've got to be within 200 or 300 yards to even hear them.
Yeah.
So, kind of exactly like where we were hunting in Colorado.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, pretty exactly like where we're hunting.
So how – I know you guys mentioned before when we had the podcast, you know, you've essentially taken the concept of let's throw a dart at a map. Let's just kind of pick a spot that looks good and go for it. Was that the plan this year going into Colorado? Mm-hmm. Who picked the spot? Kind of how was the spot picked in general? Was it new to you guys? Kind of walk us through that.
Go ahead, Cody.
Trent and I picked it the day we showed up to Colorado.
Nice. A lot of preparation. Meets opportunity kind of thing.
12-hour drive.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was one of those things. We were going to hunt a different area, or we were going to hunt an area that we've hunted in the past. We started looking at stuff and like, man, this kind of looks cool. And so we started down that rabbit trail, and it ended up in some private property in a dead end, and we couldn't even get to where we wanted to go. And I'm pretty sure the Pure Elevation guys were looking at us going, what in the are we doing right now?
So were they just like pulling you guys up on the inReach and trying to reach your point as you were like bouncing to a different spot than intended?
No, they were following us.
They were with us.
Yeah, we met in town, grabbed some burgers and beer, and then headed out. And we ended up at a dead end at a cattle ranch there that the road went right through, but they just would not allow access. So Our plan looked good on the map. It just kind of unfolded at our, when we got there to see reality. It was just one of those. We were looking for a similar area to what we'd hunt in the past, hoping for less people, and we ended up in an area at the end of it that really wasn't less people, but there was plenty of elk in there. So
I think that was one of the coolest aspects for me was, so much of what we do is scouting. I mean, just pour over Google Earth. If it's a new area, we're checking it out in the summer. And I think it was just a really cool part of this, of your whole, Land of the Free project, Cody, to just throw a dart at the map and walk in there and get into elk. I mean, it's just, I think we take that for granted. We have the ability to do that. It was such an awesome aspect of the hunt.
Yeah, when we got to the trailhead, there was, what was there, like 35 freaking vehicles there between the couple different camping parking spots. And we were all looking at each other like, this is crazy. There's no way we're going to get away from people. And we still did.
Yep.
That's great. There were seriously like that many vehicles, couple dozen plus.
Yeah, that one trailhead was ridiculous.
No, it literally, I think the truck count was 32 trucks at the trailhead.
Wow. So did you guys even hop on like the main trail from that trailhead, or you just immediately get off trail and start going a different direction?
We turned around at that point and went to a different, to a different area on that particular one. But I mean, we've definitely showed up at some trailheads in the past, and it's pretty intimidating with, eight stock trailers and some more trucks there. And there's a bunch of other people, and you just got to have some confidence you're going to go find them and call them and kill them,
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean, part of what I've run into in Colorado, and it probably depends on the spot, but, you pull up to a trailhead and it can be intimidating. I've never run into 30 plus vehicles, maybe 12 at the most, but even in the areas that I've been in at, I found that some of those guys might have been, fly fishermen who were sticking fairly close or something like that. Like, not everybody was in the elk woods, thankfully.
Well, the other end of that spectrum is if there's that many guys there, then there must be some elk there too.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's got to beat them to it.
But you know what was cool about pulling into the trailheads is I didn't see a single Washington plate or Oregon plate or California plate, because that's all we see in Idaho.
No, that is true. We didn't see any. We were definitely the out-of-towners.
So how was this working logistics-wise when you guys pack in for the first time? Did you have gear and food for X amount of days, or what was the strategy?
We kind of always talk about, like, it's pretty hard to really go spend, 7, 8, 9 days, like, in a certain spot. And as, Pure Elevation guys, we basically we do a lot of, like, 3-night, 4-day hunts. And our mentality is, if we haven't killed an elk in that time, we're packing out and find a new spot. And then second, we met up with the Born and Raised guys. They had the exact same mentality of like, all right, let's go freaking hit it hard for 4 days. That's the amount of food we brought with us. And if we haven't killed an elk by then, time to move to pack out and move somewhere else. So that was our plan going in. I think we had four days worth of food, and ended up, we got into elk immediately. So it kind of worked out. But I think that's, a good advice to people out there is don't throw all your eggs in one basket, banking on just one spot. Have plan A, B, and C, and don't be afraid to get out and find new places if you're not getting into elk.
Yeah. So how did this work with having 7 or 8 guys, however many it was, head into the woods? Did you guys set off in one group together?
Yeah. It was interesting hunting with the Born and Raised guys. I mean, Trent, you guys were saying you're all about like 5 guys in one group if you can.
Heck yeah.
That's more fun.
Heck yeah. For one, it's more fun. For two, we get two arrows out front. It's like, okay. Especially in that thick of stuff, there's so many. I mean, what were we? We were at full draw. I think we counted 13 times on that trip. And a lot of times you're just letting down just because there's so much brush and so much stuff in the way. And the more shooters, the better. And then the more callers, obviously, the more you're going to sound like a herd of elk. So yeah, we like to, like us, our perfect scenario is five guys in one team. So you got two shooters, you got two filmers, and then you got a caller in the back. So, but yeah, that's that a little different, I guess, than norm, but, it seems to be, we've been successful doing it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So our main strategy going in, Mark, was split up in threes. You know, we were in communication, we had radio, so we checked in at like 10 noon and 2, and just checked in with the other groups, see how they're doing, and it was just kind of split up. Let's find the elk and then regroup. It worked out really well.
Yeah. So you mentioned, I don't know how this worked with splitting up or even who to address this question to, but you mentioned getting into
adjust elk. It to me. How about that?
Take this. So you mentioned getting into elk right away. How did the action begin to unfold?
For which group?
It depended on which group you were in. One was so up making snow caves hunters. And angels up on top of the mountain, and the other group was down below calling in. Like, I don't know. That first day was stupid. There was elk everywhere.
So who was this first group that got into action?
not the
pure
not the ones that have elevation in their name.
Yeah. Pure elevation.
Not the ones with the motto that's to the top, I think is what they said.
Summit or bust.
Yeah.
It was pretty awesome.
Where are you guys going? Up there. But why? Because it's higher.
You can blast.
Makes perfect sense to me. Let it rip.
Always got to do it the hard way.
Yeah. As we were split up, I think the first time we went, didn't we get a bunch of sticks in our hand and draw sticks to see who was going to who?
No, that was later.
That was
later. That was later. You were sick of each other.
Yeah, we were almost on the trip.
Yeah, so the first day I split up with Cody and Trent, and then Lenny, Jason, and Tyler went together. We had hiked in the night before, all six of us camped all together in the morning, basically, you know, Lenny, Jason, Tyler went south. We went north. And I think they were into elk and we were into elk. But it was like halfway through the day, Lenny messaged me and he was there. They were up at the top of the mountain.
Like 11,000 feet.
Up there? And I was like, that's our first instinct is like, if we're running into hunters or not getting into elk, like we're just going to keep going further. And, you know, I think that was, you know, in that kind of, at home for us, that's the right motto: further, better, more elk, less pressure. But down there, all the elk, it was so thick that the elk would just stay kind of in a certain area mid mountain. And, you know, Cody and Trent and I were into elk all day long. And Lenny and Jason Tyler basically hiked themselves up into the mountain goats and completely out of the elk. And yeah, it was pretty damn comical.
What kind of pointless elevation gain did you make, Lenny?
What do we camp at?
We camped at 11,000.
We were 11 at top.
Yeah, I think 11,000.
Yeah, camp was
where? Mile at 8,200.
The night shot that Jason got. Yeah.
Camp was at 82.
Death zone for a while.
We should have been down around 8,000. That's probably where we should have been.
Yeah. Are you serious?
Yeah.
It was like 9. I think the highest we went in the head of that basin was Steve that day one was maybe 9,500 feet.
No, yeah. We pushed 10 at the
was
top.
Was it 10?
Yeah, we pushed 10 too a couple different times.
Okay.
Yeah.
The funniest thing, Mark, is Lenny and I and Jason, we're over there. And we every once in a while, we catch a glimpse of like this big open hillside with like some timber patches. And I told Lenny, I was like, man, I just got like this yearning desire to go up there to those patches and those openings. I was like, I don't know what it is, but I feel like we need to go up there. And sure enough, like in 2 hours, we were like, okay, here we are.
What are we supposed to do now?
Did you feel satisfied when you got there, Tyler? You're like, I have this urge, and you know, now I'm here.
You know, yeah, kind of. We saw one bull, but it once we got up there, it's like, we're here. This is awesome. There's one bull for the next, you know, 5 hours, but hey, we're here.
So Steve and the smarter hunters who stayed with the elk,
What did that? I mean, you said you got into multiple bulls that day. What were the opportunities coming down to?
Yeah, I mean, right. Like once we left camp that morning, we didn't go 400 yards. Got into some bulls bugling, and you know, it's pretty. Like I said, Lenny was talking about. We learned a lot from these guys. They're very, very persistent. I think in the past, if a bull was moving away from us, we probably wouldn't think we'd be able to catch up with it. Granted, some of the terrain we hunt's a lot, you know, a lot steeper, a lot bigger country, but still just like kept dogging them and dogging them and dogging them. And like in my head, I'm sitting there going, yeah, right, this isn't going to happen. And then sure enough, like Trent said, bam, all of a sudden that bull gets to a certain point and stops. And then holy crap, he's right there at 80 yards away. So that morning was that exact same thing happened. We just kind of chased this bull through this old burn, got up into the timber, got thick, and then he stopped and we were kind of cruising along and you know, he bugles and he's like right there. And one of those setups where, you know, you just kind of get pinned in a bad spot. Just, we had that happen a lot on this hunt with just terrain features of a big open spot that the bull wouldn't want to come through, or, you know, just rocks in the way, just or a little ravine. So that first bull we got into got stuck. And then I was shooter, Cody was calling, and a little bit, basically we got in that bull. Didn't happen, and Born and Raised has a cool way of hunting where they just alternate basically call-in scenarios. So if it, you know, that was like bull stopped within 100 yards, didn't happen, so it was my turn to call and Cody's turn to shoot. And Cody, so what, after we left that bull, what happened from there?
So yeah, we went up in that basin through the thick stuff and heard. It was just kind of one of those like mornings. I think that was probably like 9 o'clock or something when we made the switch, maybe a little bit later, yeah. 10 o'clock. And it was like you just kept hearing bugles, but it was, you couldn't ever get, I mean, we just kept hiking and moving up with them. And there was multiple bulls in there. And then all of a sudden when we kind of got that last little pitch, we went up that, there was a kind of a knife rock ridge, went up that and got above the basin a little bit by just 100-foot elevation gain. And bugled, and the sure enough bull was almost kind of down below us across the flat. And so we moved in on him, got busted. Like there was a satellite or some other bull on the hill that was quiet that saw us moving. And then Trent and I dropped in and you were calling. I remember it was like super thick, blowdown, rocky, kind of tough terrain to move around. And the bull closed in and we basically had a standoff at 90 yards and he was raking a tree and we had a huge rock field between us, boulder field. And you did a good job calling, keeping him busy. But Trent and I just couldn't, we kind of ran out of terrain, kind of cover and everything to move up on him. And he just physically wasn't going to just walk across this boulder field. And so I don't know that, I mean, that bull stood there for raking a tree for 20 minutes, probably.
Long time.
Yeah. And so that's when I did the three cow calls. You came up. We're like, let's do the sneak around. So Trent and I did the sneak around, and that didn't work either. The bull, by the time we got around the rock field, he was gone. And so I was back to calling then.
Yeah. On these morning bulls that are talking, are you calling back or are you simply letting them talk and trying to, you know, stay with them and move with them?
Oh, we call a lot. Yeah.
Okay.
We definitely. Yeah. It's a lot and it's loud.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because like, so me and my buddy this year, we were on the way out to our hunt and we were talking about past hunts, lessons learned, like going through scenarios. And we've realized we have gotten into a ton of freaking bulls in the morning, first thing, but we've never called one in the morning ever after getting into them like a lot. And so we were kind of curious with our own little theory of like, you know, they're talking, maybe they have an agenda, like they're headed towards their bedding area. They're not going to come. They're not going to turn. They're not going to leave. Maybe exactly. If you catch them at the right time. But we kind of formulated this theory of if we run into morning bulls on this hunt who are talking, we're going to stay as close to them for as long as we can, let them talk while they are and not even make a peep because we're not going to try and essentially change their mind about where they're going. We're just going to go with them. And I didn't know if, you know, that strategy's ever come into play for you guys.
Trent, we actually don't know how to not call. That's probably our Achilles heel is
we treat every bull as if they want us to scream in their face.
Yeah.
Every time.
Well, yeah, it works, though. I mean, you get the one.
Yeah, isn't that the change of Idaho this year? I mean,
yeah. And well, to your point, Mark, out of all the bulls we've killed over the last, I don't know, 11, 12 years, I think we're, after this project, it was, we're probably in the 70s now, but bulls killed. I think only two of them were killed in the morning. So that being said, we located a lot of them in the morning and chased them like our style holds, you know, for maybe miles, and then finally got it done by maybe mid-morning, 11, something like that. But only killed two bulls out of 70 or so in the morning with our techniques. So I think you're right on.
Yeah. Well, I don't have a bunch of experience to back it up. It was just a kind of a theory that we kind of stumbled upon this year. So it'll be interesting to play that out for sure. This episode is brought to you by Hoyt Archery. I wanted to let you guys know that Hoyt just announced their 2018 lineup. They have a new Redworks Carbon RX1 bow, kind of the successor to the Carbon Defiant, which is the bow that I've been shooting the last couple years. It's amazing to see these bow companies just improve year after year. There's several things on the Redworks Carbon RX1 that I'm excited about. They have a slick new split cable system that makes it super easy to tie in, drop away, rest without a press. But really the central feature with the split cable system and the reason they went to it primarily was to eliminate torque. They continue to have a no press required draw length adjustment on their new Hyper ZT, which is a zero torque cam. They did some crazy things with their new limb pocket and limb design. One of the things they did was lower the grip position on the bow. But to remain perfect balance with that lower grip position, they actually adjusted the limb pockets in an asymmetrical way so that one is larger and wider and heavier, and one is lighter and more narrow. And it really keeps the bow balanced perfectly with this newer grip position. So the RX1 in this new Redworks line from Hoyt looks to be phenomenal. I'm excited to check one out. I encourage you guys to check one out as well. They have them from 32-inch to 35-inch axle-to-axle lengths with speeds from 330 to 350 feet per second. So if you guys are in the market for a new bow in 2018, be sure and look at Hoyt, not only this new Carbon RX1, but their entire 2018 lineup. What's was there more action worth talking on day one? We want to kind of continue the timeline here of this trip. What the heck happened? I have no idea.
Yes. So, well, Lenny and Tyler and Jason were up, you know, chasing mountain goats and frolicking in the upper meadows.
Watching the Milky Way at night. <It's beautiful. laughs> I'm not even joking about that.
I'm mad.
Day one, man. Yeah, right after Cody, we lost that bull, or didn't lose the bull. We, you know, just the bull busted us with Cody. And when Cody was shooter, you know, we let him. You know, sometimes you got to decide, okay, it's time to like let things settle down. So we, you know, we left that bull, hiked like 200 yards, got to a good spot. Like, all right, let's sit down here. Let's hang out for an hour, kind of listen, take a little nap, let our tents dry out. Hung out for a little bit, and I don't know if it was Trent, Cody, I don't remember. Did we hear the bull I killed bugle from there, or did we?
I think it was a small bugle. Yeah.
Yeah. We heard multiple bulls bugling in that basin, and I think all of a sudden it was like, that bull's close. Let's go kill that, Steve.
Yeah. Yeah. So we basically packed up really quick, hiked, you know, a couple hundred yards, I'd say at the most. And then, we basically we were all standing together, let out a bugle, and like, oh crap, that bull's close. You know, he just responded right away. You know, we got lucky. Trent basically saved the situation here because the bull bugled, and I'm almost probably, I always thought, you know, that we were not aggressive enough, but it was kind of situational where the born and raised guys are maybe let things play out a little bit more. And so, like, the bull bugled, and my immediate reaction was, okay, I'm going to run up, like, 40, 50 yards. And literally, I took, like, two steps, and Trent grabbed me on the shoulder and, like, freaking stopped me. Like, no, he's right there. And like 2 seconds later, that bull walks up, standing there at like 25 yards. And so he walked up, and then Cody's behind cow calling, just bugling a little bit, distracting him. I come to full draw, and I had a limb right in the way. And I ducked down, thought I had a perfect shot, and I shoot, and I hit the limb. I mean, it's just clear as day. You hear the smack of a limb. The arrow goes off into space, and I look back at Trent, and he's running the camera, and about 400 cuss words came out of my mouth.
And Trent's that for calling the YouTube me down. Children.
He's like, he's right there. Reload. And Cody kept calling. And you know, luckily he's a young bull. He probably wouldn't get away with this on an older, mature bull. But he circled right back around, and I was able to shoot him at like 18 yards. It was one of those. Just smoked him. The arrow went off. Thought I made an awesome shot. You know, we're high fiving. We go back, regroup, wait like 30 minutes, and then. We go back to start following the blood, and we get there not seeing any blood at all, just super like, what's going on? I think we went like 20 yards, found my arrow, and unfortunately there was guts on it. So he's just kind of like, my heart sinks, you're just like, crap, this sucks. You don't want this to happen. You just want to make a perfect shot. So we backed out, waited like 4 hours.
Remember I spotted that bull.
Spotted the bull.
Yeah. Bedded 60 yeah. yards from where we're at, super thick. Right. You could just see bits and pieces, but you could tell he was laboring. You know, he was not feeling good. Yeah. And
so you went and found the arrow. You spotted him.
Yeah. The arrow had carried. He carried the arrow like 15 or 20 yards down the trail from where he spun.
Wow.
Yeah. So Cody luckily spotted him. We could see him breathing. Let's back out. I didn't. That's a judgment call at that point. I think 90% of the time you're better off to back out and just give it 4 hours versus trying to sneak in and make another shot. It's a really tough call to make.
And that thick cover, especially.
Yeah. Thick. Yeah. It's just, that's a hard situation to be in. We back out, wait like 3-4 hours. In the meantime, there's a bull just ripping below us like the whole freaking time. And, I'm telling Cody and Trent, like, go shoot this thing. And they're like, nope, they were dedicated to helping out and just staying with this bull. But I think after, what, it was like 3 hours, Cody, that bull ripping off, you guys finally decided, all right, let's just run down the hill 200 yards and see what happens.
Yeah. So Steve's up the hill 200 yards. Trent and I left the packs, everything, just go down. I cow call through my bugle tube, and the bull cracks off, like, 100 yards away. And every time I cow called, he answered right back, and he was coming on like fast and on a rope. And it was so thick in there. There was like this little kind of finger draw. We were right at the head of it, and it was more open on the left, and it sounded like he was going to go left. So I kind of moved down. Trent and I moved down to the left, and all of a sudden I hear something, and he's coming in on my right. And, really, really thick. And anyways, I draw thinking, okay, I've got one shooting lane, like hard right, 90 degrees to my right. And he stops at, 18 yards, bugles, and stood there for a little bit. And I finally turned around and a cow called one time. And then he lowered his head and started his way. And I swung out to the shooting lane, and right, like his nose was a foot before the shooting lane. He wins us, world's gone, and it was a big 6-point. Like, it was so close to a double. Yeah, Trent and I were watching the footage tonight, and it was like, yeah.
Trent or Cody or any of the born and raised guys that want to cover this one, you guys are used to hunting thick cover, obviously, at home and in the different states that you've hunted. Any particular, strategies or things that you've learned along the way over the years in terms of setting up four shot opportunities in thick cover? I mean, obviously you want to look for shooting lane, but when it's thick, you just kind of have to make a judgment call. Any particular strategies going through your mind for setting up for those scenarios?
Yeah, I think we went through that actually a lot on this hunt, especially just because it was so thick, and you would always be drawn and you'd have that limb. I think the piece of advice, I think, and we talked about it out there in the woods too. And I remember on the very last day, we were out there and it was in the burn with Jason. Jason was shooting and Lenny was filming and I was calling and this bull come in to you guys on a, just about a 35 to 40, maybe 37 yards. And it walked across through the burned timber. And it was like, when you see it, I think it did make sense. Cause I, it was from where I was at, it looked like it was open and I'm like, shoot, they're going to shoot. He's going to anytime he's not shooting. Why is he not shooting? Okay. The bull's running away. And so I was like, what in the world? But yeah, I think, just for with us, we have a call in our mouths at all times. And a lot of times we'll stop and we'll even move to position ourselves totally different. So it's like, you're never going to have in Roosevelt country that perfect, you know, where the beam of light shines right behind the shoulder and he's in the wide open stop and quartering away. It's like one of those things where it's like, we kind of a lot of times have to make our own thing happen, I guess, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so anyway, and just moving around and just like cow calling, taking a step to the left to already be anchored and shoot the arrow or whatever you have to do. And I think like hunting with you guys, you're like, this is so brushy. This is so thick. It's just crazy. I mean, I thought you guys were just, and it was super, super thick. I mean, it was, you could just tell that. I watched, like Cody was saying, we were watching back the footage today going, wow, that it was thick.
Well, so for me personally, when I set up, I always like to set up in front of an object, not behind it. And just let it break up my silhouette. 95% of the time I will stand up. I will not kneel down. I think a lot of guys think they need to kneel down. And sometimes those calling sequences can take 20 minutes of kneeling and then your legs are numb and then you're shaking. And also your visibility's diminished. So I think standing is a really, advantageous way to set up. And then a big part of the setup for me when it comes to crunch time is a rule of thumb: always draw your bow sooner rather than later, because I think there's so many times I've seen so many videos of guys that they try to draw their bow or they get caught and then they can't draw their bow until it's too late. And when they do, the bull spooks. And if you would have just had that bow drawn and maybe hold for a minute, then you would have had a, you know, that perfect broadside unaware bull that you could just call with your mouth call and get it done. So those are a few things, techniques that I use personally to help me.
And a lot of times in that thick stuff too, you're looking for not so much a lane, but a window, like a pocket. Yeah, exactly.
6 inches.
Yeah, you know, and it's that anticipation. If they're moving through, okay, his head comes through, his neck comes through, the front leg is almost to the thing, you call to stop him, he's going to take that step and a half, and now you have that, you know, 12-inch, 10-inch window there where behind the shoulder. And so I think for us, we've just grown up hunting in that thick cover and understanding that movement and, you know, being prepared to make that shot happen when it needs to. And then the other thing, like Trevor said, standing in front and then being in shadows versus the sun is the other huge, you know.
And a lot of that stopping them, like in that burn, I saw Jason's where that bull came in for Jason. And that's a really tough situation. If you've never been in that thick of stuff trying to stop a bull, you don't. Like when you see it and you have your shot, if he were to have tried to stop him, chances are the bull would have stopped behind a tree. Like you almost have to anticipate the bull and its movement and then call when it's behind an object, anticipating that it's going to take the step and a half in the open, and then you can make your shot. It's super tricky and really, really thick stuff.
I had a couple huge takeaways on that where it was just basically, it was a fresh burn. Everything's black. You got like dead standing matchsticks. And there was like, there's a ton of little 6-inch windows, but the bull's coming pretty quick. And he was heading for what I felt was like the most generous opening. Like if he gets that opening, I got to read my mouth. I'm going to stop him and kill him. It was 30 yards. That was going to be the end of the story. He never made it to that opening, but there's a bunch of little windows on the way that you guys are talking about that I probably could have tried to stop him. But my fear was that as soon as I cow call, he's going to just peg me. And so if that window isn't there, you know, I'm going to be kind of screwed unless his head's behind a tree and then I can take a sidestep. And I, you know, Lenny was filming. I did draw and I drew three times and I was taking sidesteps trying to get a shot. And one thing Trent brought up that was huge for me is that he was telling me if I would have heard you cow call, I would have started going crazy over there because Trent was laying on the ground raking a tree.
Literally, like a snow angel.
The rut angel.
The rut angel.
Yeah, I think we need a little YouTube tutorial on the snow angel tree raking. Get that on the list.
That whole scenario, that was a tough, tough deal just because, I mean – he takes three more steps, he's in the wide open, you got perfect shot. Or, you know, you try to stop him early, then you're going to kick yourself, you know, for that. So, I mean, yeah, it was a totally tough scenario. But what I was just getting at with the whole trip is just like sometimes you got to make it happen yourself. It's not always just going to happen. And so sometimes getting busted over just trying to get a window or something, you know, sometimes it's got to – that's just what happens. But no, it was difficult situation, big time.
Yeah, I mean, the truth of the matter is like this is an art, right? It's not a science, and it only comes with experience. And it's never like a black and white. That was right, that was wrong, you know. And so it's just with experience on, you know, in that moment, what can you do to make a slightly better odds of making that happen? And that's really what it comes down to, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And exactly. I obviously wasn't there and didn't see the footage, but from what you said, Jason, it's like if he's headed towards an opening, I mean, by default, I would think you're making the right call. I mean, if he's headed that direction, I would want him to get there versus trying to force a small window before he got there type thing, you know?
I think if Trent would have been like a little angrier, like Snow Angel.
That probably would have made
the Snow Devil.
I guarantee it. If I would have had to hike one more hill with you guys, I think it would have probably made all the difference in the world, clear to the top.
All right, so we have a bull on the ground at this point that we haven't gotten back to yet. So let's revert to that story. Well, Steve, you want to take
We got to give that 4 hours.
Yeah. We got 3 hours, three and a half hours to fill.
That's kind of what we do. Like, so if there's an animal hitting the guts, we try to give it at least 4 hours, try to. Depending on daylight and depending on conditions and stuff too, obviously. But yeah, we try to give that bull some time just to lay down and do its own thing. Well, that was all the signs that pointed us that direction. With when we looked at the arrow, it wasn't blood. It was like fatty tissue and
yeah, it was zero blood. It was green. Yeah,
it was guts. And we're like, that is so weird. Cause I saw him hit it too. And I thought it was just money. I thought the shot was perfect. And so we did. We gave the bull time getting back to it. We walked, another 50 yards from where we saw it. And
I'm curious, with him spotted, was it on the table if the wind was decent to stay where you could see him?
We kind of all three, him and Hod, are about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I personally wanted to stay and look because it was just like, then you know.
Yeah.
I've had an experience before where I shot a bull and turns out I hit it in the shoulder, but that bull went out, bedded down, and we backed out of there. I even watched it, you know, like he, you know, bedded down and I thought he was going to die right there. And we backed out, came back and never saw hide nor hair, blood anywhere, that elk. And, you know, my gut was like, after that, I wanted to, where I could have visibly stayed and watched that thing. At least I would have known which way he went or, you know, what, you know, if he got up, you could see blood on him or not. So that's a tough, because all of a sudden the wind shifts and you blow that thing out of there.
Yeah.
Now what, you know?
Yeah. That scenario you're talking about, the past one, I think looking back, I think a hunter had come in and unbeknownst to us had bumped him. Someone not from our party and, you know, we never found him.
But yeah, yeah, so I, that was Steve's call there.
Yeah, it just, it was where we could actually see him. We were only 70 yards away ish.
Yep. Where's that? Yeah, it was,
yeah, it was that far. It was pretty close. It was just super thick. You know, I definitely, like, you're assessing the situation. I would have had to come from above him. There was a lot of brush to get a second shot in. And we were close enough that I just didn't feel comfortable sitting there with, if a wind shifted and then he got, you know, if they get wind of you, they can get a whole new burst of adrenaline and run for a long distance. So
yeah,
yep,
we backed out.
Totally agree.
Yeah. We backed out and it ended up being the right thing to do. You know, who knows? Well, it didn't matter because once we backed out, waited the 4 hours. By the time we went back in there, he had gone a whopping like 50 yards and was dead. And we got to him and he was full on rigor mortis, stiff as a board. So he'd been dead for quite a while.
Started to bloat. Yeah.
Yeah. Started bloating. The nastiest thing down there was the blowflies. We don't have to deal with those in Idaho. That was freaking disgusting. We rolled that bowl over, and I mean, I think Trent was right there next to me. And 1,000 flies came out from underneath the bottom of him. That was,
it was crazy. Yeah, I'd never even seen anything like that. No, that's crazy.
In that short amount of time, they had blown all over his hide. Looked like just white.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, on the underside of it.
Horrifying.
Two 12-inch patches at least of just white maggot. It was, yeah, it was disgusting.
Wow.
In 4 hours?
Yeah. It was quick. It was quick.
Wow.
Which that proceeds into a great conversation about quality game bags, which Trent proceeded to let us hear about it for the next 9 days.
Who had the pillowcases?
Trent really bites his tongue really well, doesn't he, Steve?
Oh, yeah, super well. So, yeah, we got him cut up, quartered up, and I pull out my game bags. All I had was tag bags for deboning stuff, and Trent was just shaking his head. Because we were going to throw there's no reason to debone. We were only like 3-4 miles from the truck, and we had plenty of guys to pack it out. So, I think we got them all quartered up and loaded them up and started hiking out.
And that's when we did some man stuff, packing meat.
That's man. I don't know when Trent invented man stuff on this trip, but that became hashtag man stuff.
I want to hear about the man stuff, Trent. But before that, I know we're going to get emails if we don't address this. What is the game bag of choice from you, sir?
You know, I don't know. I don't know. I think there could be better options out there. Yeah, but I would. What I have is the quarter bags.
Caribou?
They're caribou bags.
Caribou.
And okay. They're like ginormous. They're huge.
Yeah.
That way you can cover the whole, because we're used to flies like that. That's not anything out of the ordinary. That situation, on the other hand, was like above and beyond. But we're used to having flies every single kill that we have around here. And so if the fly touches that meat and it blows on that meat while it's hanging or something, it's like you're going to have to be cutting a lot of it off. It's nasty. It can get really, really nasty. So definitely meat care is like top of the priority for us. And we carry huge, huge game bags. And that way we can take the whole quarter, put it in the whole quarter. And then, you know, duct tape the top of it or electrician's tape or whatever to where it's nothing can get in that meat.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think tag bags are good. It's just a matter of, you know, whether you're keeping whole quarters or not is the point.
Right. Yeah. I had some cheap Alaskan game bags that for us work when we're packing out bone out meat because we don't – pretty rare. One, we've never seen blowflies like that here in Idaho. Not even 1/100th what we saw there. And two, typically we don't hang meat for very long. It's a night at the most, and we pack it out. You know, we're so invested in a country where we're 5-6 miles from the truck. If, you know, there's 2 or 3 of us hunting and we get a bull down, we're packing it out of there. In this scenario, we had so many guys, the goal was just go pack them kind of down to the trail. And then, you know, that meat, it was cold enough that meat could have hung for a week. And that's where we were really worried about the flies. And Trent luckily had 28 pounds of game bags in his pack and came to the rescue.
I didn't even have a tag either. No, what I like too is like where the distance that we were is because we didn't have to bone the elk out, which is the best case scenario for us, is because we can hunt longer that way. because we can hang it with the quarter with the bone in. It drains way better. It drains the blood out better. When you bone out meat, especially right off the animal, it's still pretty fresh. And so what will happen is those folds will get on top of other folds of meat, and they'll actually have pockets of blood that hang in that meat. And whenever you can, if it's within like where we were at, probably 3 miles and closer to the pickup or wherever you're going to hang your meat, I always try to hang it with the bone in, just because it'll last longer too, and it allows us to hunt longer. So that's, and I don't know.
Another thing is, not all game bags are created equal.
No.
I mean, if you get a great deal on game bags and say, yeah, I got, you know, all these quarter bags for $10 or $20, and those blowflies, they can burrow through some game bags that don't have really good material to them. So we've had trouble with some game bags in the past. So, you know, that's what we're all doing it for. You hike around those woods for, you know, 10, 20, 30 days or whatever. When you get an animal down, the last thing you want is to come up on your meat after letting it, you know, hang for a few days and having that fly blow in there and your meat's ruined. So,
speaking of getting our meat, to cut you off, but Cody, let's talk about the rib roll. That we got to talk about that. That was so badass.
Oh, yeah. So that was kind of an interesting one. I'd never done it before, but when we were in Wyoming with Elk 101, Dirk, you haven't heard about this, the rib roll. So Dirk was like, he was at Trent's Bowl, he's like, man, I've never done it either, but I've heard about this technique. And so what it was, I started at the back rib, and I took that Benchmade knife and ran it basically right at the back of the rib and filleted the rib. And then as I got to the end of the rib, working forward, I turned the knife, cut down. So now it's on the front side of the rib, cutting between the ribs, cut that meat. So now that I filleted it off the bone, and then I've cut it from the bone. And then as I go up to the very top and the very bottom, and all that, the meat between the ribs is now free. And then I come into the back of the next rib and cut up and then fillet it off of the bone as well. And it's one continuous meat. So then I just roll it forward and then basically keep repeating forward. Hmm. And it turns out it was like probably a 5 or 6 inch diameter tube of additional rib meat that was
a ton.
Yeah, I mean, it was probably.
So you're kind of like, you know, arcing over the profile of the rib bone.
Yeah. So basically the whole technique, once you come from one, you keep that meat rolling forward and then you, you basically fillet it from the back side of the bone onto the flat side of the rib on the outside, and then cut down, you know, and you basically just peel that meat off the rib bone, but, then keep it in one continuous piece of grind. And, I mean, you think about it, it's another 10 to 15 meals, you know?
Yeah. It was amazing how much, I mean, I think Steve, you'd agree, wouldn't you? It was pretty, it was quite a bit of meat.
It was
a
solid 10 pound chunk of meat that came off. I mean, here in Idaho, we're not required to take rib meat. And I think most of the time we don't, because like, if you just do drop the knife in between two ribs and you pull out that little strip of meat, you're like, oh gosh, this isn't that much. But when you actually cut it like Cody did, you basically just kept rolling the knife through the ribs and just kept rolling the meat forward. It was a substantial chunk of meat. It was like eye opening. I'm like, I was pissed off that we hadn't done that in the past. I mean, when Lenny killed his bull here, we did it on his, and yeah, it's freaking awesome. I'll never not do that again.
Yeah, I would totally agree. That was, and it was really easy. I'd never seen it done, and I started playing, you know, cutting it from the back of the rib forward, and it all came off really easy. And like you said before, I've always like cut in between the ribs, and there really wasn't, you know, much of a piece of meat. And this whole way, you know, put a pretty good chunk together.
That's awesome. Well, cool.
So keep moving forward.
Yeah, man. Yeah, what happens?
Day one.
The most epic, insane bugling I've ever heard in my entire life that night.
Oh,
yeah.
Just to the amazing point where sometimes you actually want them to shut up type thing?
No, I never get tired of that.
No, at 3 a.m. I wanted them to shut up.
I was going to say, I've had those nights where I'm like, oh, this is awesome for like 2 or 3 or 4 hours, and then you get to the point where I just want to sleep for a little bit.
Yeah, the best part about this is, you know, we kill an elk. I'm texting Lenny, like, into bulls all day. This is awesome. We camp at night. Bulls bugling all over. And Meanwhile, they're up in freaking the clouds and not here to see crap. They're pissed off.
They were literally above the tree line.
Oh.
Those views, yeah. Though, Lenny, right?
No, yay, man. That's half the reason I hunt. Honest God. Yeah, it is. Yeah. I mean, elk are half of it, the views are the other half. So I got half of it, just not the other half.
One half's better than
it. It was pretty cool that the very next night, or the next afternoon, I can't remember what happened the next day. We packed meat. I can't remember. Anyway, probably some elk stuff. And anyway, but the next night, we met up with all the guys, and Lenny was kind of, what did we call him? Glass half empty, pessimist.
Negative Nancy.
Negative Nancy.
Negative Nancy. All these things. And he's just like, there's no elk here, da 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 da. And we're like, let's go hunting. Let's go. And so we took off, and it was just, it just worked out really, really well that there was a bull within, I don't know how far it was. It wasn't that far from where we left everybody to where we split up and called it in. It was one of those scenarios where just like, I don't know, a ton of them that we're going to talk about probably tonight, but it's right or left, you know, just a couple inches, you know, bow hunting's a game of inches, and just a couple inches and he could have got a shot at it. But nice, what was it, 5-point, Lenny? Something like that?
Yeah, yeah, super strong 5-point. But I got to back up here, Trent. This is something that you haven't heard yet.
Oh, good,
so,
good.
All right, so you got to realize, like, I've only met Trent like once or twice, and so the night before, I get on the radio. You ready for this, Tyler?
Yeah.
All right, so we get on the radio that night. We're camped at like 11,000 feet, like pissed off. What are we doing up here? And we get on the phone, and I radio Steve. He's like, yeah, we killed the bull. And Trent gets on the radio, right? And I barely know Trent, right? I met him. He gets on there and starts telling me about, well, this is what you got to do. Well, what are they all doing? You need to be doing this. You need to be doing that. You need to be doing this. And my hands, I'm like, what the f*** is this Trent guy? I go back to the camp and I'm like, dude, like this guy just like read me the riot act here. Like, well, what if you?
Oh
god. The bugle would have been hiking up the hill. Like, I don't know what the hell's going on here.
What's super funny to me, Lenny, is when I was up for the death hike, I specifically remember talking about this trip, and you're like, yeah, it's going to be so fun to, like, hunt with some other guys and kind of learn their strategies and kind of have them give me some perspective on maybe other things to do.
Oh, dude, I was just, like, pissed off that night. Like, Trent literally gets on there for, like, 5 minutes, like, tells me what to do, and I like hang up the phone or hang up the radio, and I'm like, God.
It turns out.
I would just blame it on Alton.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Trent was completely right. But at that point in time, like, we hiked our butts off. Like, we'd hiked hard and hunted hard and, like, weren't seeing crap. They're like, elk are everywhere. They're bugling. And, you know, I'm so sick of this. And, I mean, I was just so pissed off. Yeah, the next day they're like, oh, come on, man. All right, we'll take you under our wing, Lenny. Let's go show you, like, in 15 minutes, like a bull. I'm at full draw. It was a learning experience. Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, man. I didn't know it went down like that.
it was awesome, honestly. It was like, after I got to know you in the next couple of days, I was like, all right, I get it.
Oh, man. We had a blast hunting with you guys, though. I mean, the fun that we shared, it's cool. I can't wait to show it all on when we launch it all for this November. It's going to be an epic hunt. So.
Man stuff.
Yeah.
Where are we at now? Day three.
Yeah, I mean, listeners. I guess that it's every day kind of ran together in there because, yeah, like we said, we were into good bugling bulls, close calls every single day. Someone was at full draw, if not once or twice a day, and we kind of started alternating teams. I think the next day, was Tyler, Trent, and I, and then Steve, Lenny, and Jason. And Tyler, you were up in the morning, right?
Together, we ended up at the top.
Yeah, I was up that morning.
Yeah, they ended up at top again. I remember we chased that bull. Because we all camped together again that night, and then which was fun. That was the one thing. Like, there's the backpack hunting is awesome, and bivy hunting and splitting up and covering ground. But having that night time together to like regroup and share memories is, I don't know. The more and more we do this, and like you think about, you've only got so many elk seasons in your life, and if you just grind it away, I think at the end of it you look back and go, man, that's not what it's all about. And you know, I would sacrifice a little bit of sleep to stay up and share that time at night with everybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
I agree.
Yeah, that night when we all met back, I mean, it was like a flat on toad soaking downpour, right? And we all got back there. Was that the night that we went out?
That was a couple nights later.
That was the monsoon, the great monsoon of 2007.
The great monsoon.
That night, the next day is when we chased that bull up the face, straight up that face. Remember, you were shooter, you climbed.
Yeah, right. Dude. That was my like. I know I've heard Steve and Lenny both, I think, mention takeaways from hunting with you guys, and my big takeaway from hunting with you guys, honestly, is I don't know how many bulls I've quit in my life because they're going the opposite direction. I mean, seriously, I just like a herd bulls, you know, like, well, they got their cows, they're going, they're gone. And with you guys, I learned that gone is really not even in the vocabulary anymore.
Yeah,
unless they wind you.
I mean, the epitome of that. Because what did we chase that bull? Probably 2.5 miles, probably.
Oh, yeah. We heard him bugle a long ways away. Went and just kept like, oh, there he is. Well, he might be that direction. And I'm like, the bull's gone, man. He's lost. And all of a sudden, you know, you get him to pipe off again. And that was my biggest takeaway, is to not quit bulls. I kicked myself so many for looking back on the last, you know, 15 years of whatever hunting, and think of all of the bulls I quit because they just went quiet, and I'm like, oh, well, they're done, they're not going to work out. That was my big, I mean, honestly, that was my big takeaway from you guys, was don't quit them, because they're just in that scenario. I think you guys said all the elk are just, they're just going somewhere to stop.
Yeah. They have a destination they want to be, and that bull, especially, he had a destination he wanted to be. He wanted to be over that farthest ridge, clear over the top. And so we just followed him and chased him. And a lot of times we couldn't get him to bugle. Remember, it was take like 3 or 4 bugles before finally we'd hear a woo way, way up and over. Yep. And okay, we'd have a direction to go in then. And so we'd keep going and keep going. And that was a really cool scenario, because we ended up calling that bull once he got to a spot that he just wanted to be for some reason. We got in on him and then and called him into what, seven yards, Tyler, something like that.
Seven yards.
Yeah. And again, it was just one of those no shot. I mean, there was limbs in the way, and he's so close to pulling the trigger. Anyway, just didn't feel comfortable about it because there was too much brush but we did call it in. I mean, it was a definite close encounter.
That's something that Cody taught me several years ago when we first started hunting with each other. We had a bull just like that. It was moving away. Thought it was done playing the game. And Cody looked at me and he said, "He's not done hunting." He said, "He just can't hear us."
Yeah.
And sure enough, I mean, we went over a ridge and around the corner, and we blew the bugle, and you know, he sounds off. And so I think more often than not, it's not that they're done with the game, it's just they can't hear you. So you just got to stay on them.
Yeah, I mean, I 100% agree with that. I mean, it was like t- time after time after time, I mean, I thought they were gone, and these guys would literally be like, oh, they just can't hear us. And I'm like, what do you mean they can't hear us? And so, I mean, like, these guys are the loudest buglers you ever heard in your life. Like, I'm half deaf. I got to put my ears. And, you know, we'd go around the corner. I mean, and sure enough, you know, they'd sound off again. I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah, I'd never heard anyone say, hey, I'm going to bugle, plug your ears. I was like, what?
Well, one thing I like that you guys have is just your attitude and your rule about the eights. Trent, Cody, you want to elaborate?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The rule of eight. So that's kind of our rule. Well, it was in Colorado the time before, because we hadn't hunted that. You wouldn't hunt Colorado within, 3 years?
Yeah.
I think it was.
13 and 14.
Before we went this year. And so, but when we were there before, there was a ton of elk, and as the same as this year, but, and a lot of bulls, but, it seemed like we had the rule of eight. Every single, you'd need eight elk, you know, encounters before one actually went right. And, it kind of rang true, I think, through this whole trip too. I mean, yeah, you might get one in between that and everything, but we were on a lot of bulls, and it was definitely a ton of practice for us too, as far as, okay, what did we do wrong there? Or how'd we screw that up? And it's always a learning curve for us too. It's just, you never know, you know, I mean, you never know what they want to hear at the time. So,
yeah, I mean, it's just a good attitude to have, to not like get too down, you know, and kind of give up on a hunt. Just know like, okay, it's going to take eight encounters for things to go right. You know, I mean, so many things have to go right as a bow hunter. And just so to have that patience and keep after it and know, you know, whether it's encounter four or encounter six or eight, eventually it's going to go in your favor and that bull's going to give you a shot and an arrow's going to get released.
Yeah.
Well, and that's a big, like, and it's really easy if one person gets negative, the next, you know, it kind of spreads like a virus from there and it can, you know, ruin it. It's just,
is that
tough.
Why you so made Lenny sleep out of camp that night?
Yeah. No, and so like we just try to keep each other in check. We've always done that. If someone's down, we try to like build them back up, so it like, you know, gets that fire back and going again for everyone. So,
you know, I say that like the one takeaway. I mean, there are several takeaways, but the ones that are most significant for me was one, not quitting the bulls, and then Steve kind of touched on, or maybe it's Jason that touched on it, that the you guys back there hunting the Rosies, you guys don't look for lanes, you look for windows. And that first bull that Cody called in for me, Trent was on the camera. You know, I replay that in my mind. Even I was thinking about it yesterday, which sucks. Like I carry these things through, you know, and then I guess it's a learning thing, you know, to try to get in my mind. But there was like a, you know, maybe a 12-inch window with a stick through the middle of it, and the bull was like 25 yards at that. I mean, I can shoot a fly at 25 yards, and I kick myself for thinking I need a lane instead of realizing, like, I mean, that window is, if I can shoot a dime on a target at 20 yards, why can't I shoot through a 6-inch opening, you know, 20 yards away? And it's just this whole mindset of, I feel like I need a lane instead of a window. And that was a huge takeaway for me to, if you have the confidence at 20 yards on a target with nothing there, really, it shouldn't be any different with a 6-inch window at 20 yards. That was huge for me.
Yeah. That makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. No, I watched that hunt about, 20 minutes before we started this podcast. I was, Cody and I were watching that, that exact hunt, Tyler. It was awesome. That was a really cool bull. But I mean, it's always, that's the cool thing about hunting and hunting as a team. It's always the guy that's in the driver's seat. It's his call. It's his, you know, because it's so easy to be back there and go, oh man, you know, he should have shot, or I could have got an arrow through there or whatever. It's never, and that's why we all have to keep so positive as far as, because I could tell you, after that, you're like, gosh, could I? I know I could have. Why didn't I shoot? But at the time, you didn't see it, so you didn't shoot, and that was that was the right call. I mean, that you know, you didn't feel comfortable. So, but it was an awesome call in, and we got on a bunch more that day too. Cody and you, I think, traded shooter what, like five times, six times?
Yeah, Yeah, it was a good day, no doubt.
Yeah, it was awesome. That was an awesome day.
That's super cool. So I gotta ask. You know, we mentioned the length of this entire project, and we'll talk a bit more about the project here in a second. But you know, after going through all of that, Cody and Trent, you know, just want to hear what was it like now on the other side of this. What are some of the big takeaways of, you know, hunting in that many states, being on the road that much, not just, you know, hunting takeaways, but just in general, like now that you're on the other side of this experience, what are some of the things that stand out? Obviously we're not going to give it away cause it's going to be, watched by everyone, but for you guys personally, what are some of the things that stand out?
You know, it's been an interesting one for me. My wife always, blames me for having FOMO, and I didn't know what that was, but it's that fear of missing fear of missing out. And I know when I got home, so I wasn't on the entire project.
Are you sure your wife's saying FOMO and not something else?
Yeah, exactly. You want to spend how many days
on Cody better than me?
You know, the hard part for me was actually coming home. It was, don't get me wrong, like it was very tough being gone, but it was really tough not being apart through the whole thing. Just because each state had different groups and like different experiences throughout the whole thing. I mean, every camp was totally different dynamic. And you know, hunting with Pure Elevation guys, the takeaways of what I learned on gear and how to pack and how things, you know, how to be efficient in movements in the woods. And, like with Corey and Dirk and Donnie was a different experience. The calling dynamic, like, you know, Lenny said that we're loud and you stand next to Dirk and he blows a bugle and you're just like, what the heck? And then hearing from Steve and Trent in about Montana, yeah, hearing Phelps bugle and said that he was 10 times louder than anyone they've ever heard. And,
I've never heard anyone louder than Phelps.
He can bugle loud.
So, I mean, just that... the hardest part is just not being there to experience it all. So it's kind of fun now to be able to go through all the footage and see it all. But in that long of time, you know, I was gone the first time. I was gone for 25 days away from home, came back. I was here for, I think, 12 and then gone for another 5 at the other end of it. And it is a long time. And, you know, when I left, it was summertime and now it's like mid late fall here. You know, family, my son, who's now 3 months old, you know, I was gone for a third of his life. And that was a tough thing to realize when I got home. You know, things change when you're gone just in that short amount of time. So missing out, you know, being gone that long's tough. But chasing elk, like you said, in the month of September, it only comes around once a year. So you got to make it count while you're there. And that's what, you know, that positive attitude and embracing every day. You know, we had some encounters with rough weather there. In hindsight being, it's like we should have, you know, I should have wanted to push harder in some of those times. You know, we burned a day trying to find another spot to hunt because we wanted to move. And, you know, that hindsight of thinking that, you know, there's gold at the other end of the rainbow somewhere else. And, you know, we didn't experience it when we packed up and moved and ended up coming back the last couple of days to where we were at originally. You know, kind of one of those things when you're in the moment, you don't think about it till when you kind of pull yourself back from it. It's like, maybe you shouldn't have made that move, you know, and burnt that daylight time.
Mm. How about you, Trent?
Yeah. I just got home actually just a couple days ago, and it was amazing to see the family. My wife actually flew out to Montana to ride home with me. And so, yeah, it was, family-wise, it was difficult. I had to really kind of pull it together. I had a great support. I got to, I had one of the DeLorms and got to actually talk with my wife almost daily, you know, through text. And so that helped a boatload. And she was super supportive. She was just as, I mean, more so than me at times, you know, and she's just like, you're sticking, you know, we're doing this whole thing. And so it was really cool to have that support team, but just the people that I got to meet and the different teams that I got to hunt with, you guys included, just, and I, you know, this podcast is making it sound like we taught you guys a ton of stuff, but I learned a ton of stuff from you guys too. Like Cody said, as far as the packing thing and just little things about the pack and about your guys's, about EXO and the company. And I mean, I took away a ton from Tyler. It was great being able to hunt with him. We shared some great time together and some good fellowship.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's the experiences that I went through. I was gone for 52 days in all hunting elk. Not a lot of people have ever done that before, so I thought that was pretty neat. Pretty crazy. Yeah. So it was a long time.
Yeah, I feel real bad for you.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, it was the different groups that I got to hunt with was definitely, and like Lenny said, you know, Trent was an ass right off the bat saying all those things, but it's, get this, you get with a new team and then you got to figure out, okay, how do they hunt and how can I adapt or to be a better hunter every single time, you know, is what every single team taught me. And cause certain states like Idaho, it was all glassing and sitting there on your butt and not moving and finding these elk, picking them up in sagebrush and junipers and really open country. And so that was just like a totally different thing for me. And so, yeah, it was all that combined into one, and the camaraderie you get. The people have asked me, what's the hardest part, honestly, of this whole thing? And for me, it was when, every single, 10 days or so is what we had with each team before I had to move on to the next state. It was leaving the guys, actually, because you create a bond. I mean, we created just, a group of guys that worked together to do something greater. It was pretty amazing. And so, that was the hardest thing for me, honestly, is leaving my brothers and going and trying to get new relationships. So, but it was a great experience. One that I will definitely not soon forget. That's for sure.
No, yeah, and I'll completely say that. Like I said, the first day, honestly, I didn't know Trent. I knew Cody a little bit, and from Trent getting on the radio and saying that to me, and honestly, it rubbed me wrong. And I'm like, who is this guy? And then, you know, I hunted with him for the next 6 days, and I've never met anyone who hunted as hard as him without a bow in his hand. And so positive and got after it, man. I mean, had so much respect for him at the end of it. And you know, felt like I had a connection with him. It was an awesome experience for me, honestly.
Likewise. It was amazing.
Cool. That's awesome.
Let's go talk about Doug Flutie. So,
goddamn.
So Trent, I believe Doug Flutie comes from you guys, right? I'm trying to replay all this, but that's a guy.
I think Trevor actually. I think Trevor made up the. I think he's the one that named it actually.
Okay.
It's so perfect.
So the typical Primos Terminator bugle, the three pitch, you know. So we had moved spots, and Cody referred to earlier, we, you know, after a few days we hadn't killed an elk, we decided to try a new spot and drive south. And Jason and I were hunting. We'd split up. It was completely new country, so we split up in three groups of two. And Jason and I were hunting together, and Tyler and Trent were hunting together, and they were kind of south of us. And we Jason and I were hunting along, and we had just had a bull 70 yards, and he winded us and blew away. And we're kind of hiking along, and I bugle, and we hear this bugle that, I mean, until you watch the video, you're not going to understand how awful it was. And hopefully the audio catches it. But it was the most random bugle that you'd ever heard, where Jason and I are just looking at each other, shaking our heads, and you're like, that's a hunter. Wait, no, that's an elk. Wait, no, that's a hunter. And the son of a gun called us in to 50 yards because it was it was so bad. And Jason, you know, I was calling for Jason, he was shooter, and he was in front of me, and he saw the guy literally sitting in the middle of this rock patch in the wide open, just sitting on a rock, just blowing on his bugle tube. And it was not an hour after that, we met up with Trent and Tyler, and we're literally, we're hiking out of this country. I mean, climbing up this, you know, we got this pretty steep hill to get out, to get back to the truck. And we're like, you know, a third of the way heading that direction. And we hear a bugle behind us. And I can't even like tell the story without just laughing the entire time. And Jason had already been called in by this guy. I mean, this is the worst part of it. But we turned our, you know, we're like Trent and Tyler right there. They're hearing the exact same thing that we're hearing. And it was, I don't know. Trent, Tyler, anyone want to chime in here? Because I'm going to get lost, but it's beyond.
So go ahead,
it's
Tyler.
It's beyond comedy.
Oh, ahead, it was. Yeah, it was one of those things that like, you sit there and everybody looks at each other like five times, you know, you look at each other and like, what was that hunter or elk? And like they're saying earlier, there's no way that a hunter would purposely sound that bad. It was just, yeah, it was insane.
I think the part that got us was like, he was moving away from us and Trent was bugling. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's not too many elk hunters out there on the mountain, maybe 0.5% that could hear Trent bugle at 300 yards and go, oh, that's a hunter. I'm going to walk away.
Yeah.
Right.
Trent had this sounded like a bull to that guy. Yeah. And yet he was moving away from us.
He was too. And I mean, I'm not kidding. He was bugling like a lot. And it was like, yeah. A hunter wouldn't do that, I don't think. And so we had to go investigate.
So freaking Doug Flutie, like we're a third of the way up this climb, and he called us back, I think a solid mile.
Solid mile.
And Jason and I had already been called in by this guy, but it was so like, they just couldn't believe that a hunter would have that. Like, there was just no strategy, literally. Or he was either deaf and couldn't hear us talking, was just moving away. Or maybe he had some master game plan that he was trying to pull this bull towards him. I don't know.
So you got called in by him twice?
Yes, twice.
Yes.
That was like, if this is a hunter, yeah. We are burning his footage because we're so freaking embarrassed.
Yeah. Oh, that's good.
Once individually and then once as a whole group.
You know, when Trent got to Idaho, he didn't tell me that story.
Oh, man, that one hurt. Well, we got called in again, didn't we? On Steve, remember that guy that came up and turkey called in front of us?
We're like, oh, yeah. No, that was my fault. Both you and Cody were like, that's a human. I was like, I don't know.
But. Yeah, but still, we ride together, we died together. Oh man,
that was like that almost the highlight of the trip for me was Doug Flutie, man. It was too much.
That's funny.
Oh,
well, cool. Let's wrap this up. The good thing is there's a heck of a lot more I know we could talk about, but most of that's going to be revealed in the YouTube series. So just to recap, Cody, give us the rundown on how this is launching, when it's launching, where folks need to go to check out not only the footage from the hunt we've discussed tonight, but, you know, all the rest of the states, all the other hunts that you guys have been on this fall.
Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing is listeners just go to the Born and Raised YouTube and hit the subscribe button. It's Born and Raised Outdoors there on YouTube. And basically everything kicks off Wednesday, November 1st, 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. So it'll be a daily upload on the channel. So every day at 5 p.m., you will get to enjoy this whole journey along with us. Trent has been hard at work on the editing side. We're going to be cranking videos, like I said, every day. New upload, new video, new story. New adventure. So it's like I said, Wednesday, November 1st, 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Set a reminder on your phone right now, in your calendars.
And it runs for 45 days? You're doing
Yeah, it's probably going to be more, actually. Looking at the footage and what we've got to keep it, I could see this definitely kicking into Christmas and probably, you know, 55, 60 day video uploads. So
that's going to be super cool.
And my, I just want to touch on real quick, Mark, as far as the theme behind the whole project of Land of the Free is, my whole take out of this and what I would love other people to be inspired by is just we were all of us. We honestly didn't show it just because we didn't want to give our location away. But we went over the counter and bought these tags, went to the nearest outdoor store or whatnot and bought these tags. Anybody can do exactly what we did. Anybody. I mean, we honestly, I think Steve can agree. We didn't hike that awful hard, really. I mean, where the elk were. Anybody can do this if you guys just, I mean, come out west and put your head down and just try something new because the adventures that we had together, I mean, were just, I mean, life-changing and memorable. That's something that we're all going to remember for the rest of our lives. And so, yeah, that's my whole take is anybody can do what we did on this hunt. It's not that difficult. And just get out there and do it, you know. Just don't do it in my spot.
And if you do, don't sound like Doug Flutie.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, fellas.
And the other,
yeah, go
just
ahead,
real Cody. Quick on the other side of that, this whole thing spawned from growing up here locally. I felt like we kind of hit, the Oregon Roosevelt and the Timberlands, what we hunted in its peak. And a lot of access changed around here. It's always been private timberlands, but it's been basically open for public no matter what. Aside from fire danger. And about 3 years ago, they went to a permit system where it was a paid access. And so it kind of takes, you know, the opportunity away for a lot of people. I mean, not only think about a first-time bow hunter buying a bow and all the gear, and then they got to, you know, spend a few hundred dollars for a permit. So when we've hunted out of state, we've always hunted on public lands, and we really wanted to embrace, you know, and let that word be known that you can lose the public lands and, you know, some things that are going on. So we teamed up with backcountry hunters and anglers in order more to raise the awareness, to be active. It's pretty easy. I know for me, you know, I'm 35 years old, but all through my teens and 20s and into my early 30s, it's like, conservation, it's not, you know, that's for a bunch of old guys to go to a banquet and bid up on some auction. And there's a lot of things that guys can get involved now and to make a difference, you know, on some of these House resolution bills that are getting put in and let the senators know that, you know, you got to keep those public lands open for access for the public and not transferred to state, and which then typically turns into private lands. So, as a state, sell them all.
Hey, Mark, can we go over kind of like our takeaway from everybody on this?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, for sure.
All right. So my takeaway from this is like the born and raised guys, they bugle with attitude and emotion. Like even this year when Steve and I were up hunting by ourselves, Steve came back to me. He's like, it sounds just monologue. Like you got to put some emotion into it, which we never would have said, you know, 1 year earlier. So like my takeaway is like, you can't just go through the motions. Like you got to have some emotion to your bugles, which makes all the difference in the world. And then also, you know, honestly, it was just, just the persistence and the attitude that we learned from those guys was, it was a huge takeaway for us.
Cool. How about you, Tyler?
Mine definitely was not quitting the bulls. Not thinking, you know, it's archery hunting. There's not always going to be the perfect shot, you know, like the wide open 8 foot lane broadside, like the sun gleaming on their vitals, you know, feel confident in the shot that you practice all year to make. That was a big one for me. And then the other big takeaway was just, honestly, like just the brotherhood connection that we made with the born and raised guys. I mean, we all knew them, you know, but, I mean, knowing them on a different level was super cool for me.
Yeah, this is Trent. That would be my biggest takeaway in the whole thing is just the relationship that we made with you guys through that time. I mean, like Lenny, now I feel so privileged to be able to see you at ATA or whatnot and just run up to you, give you a big hug and just be like, hey man, how's it going? And being able to talk shop and it's just, just that part of the whole thing. And meeting Jason, I'd never met Jason before. He just great guys, great group of guys. You guys were so much fun to hunt with. That's my biggest takeaway in the whole thing is just how cool you guys are and how likewise we are. You know, everybody works together and everybody carries the load, you know, the next guy's load if he has to. So that's what I give. That's my takeaway.
How about you, Jason?
I could probably sum it up in just a few words. Camaraderie, man stuff. And just enjoying the hunt. I mean, I'm a mule deer guy, and most of the mule deer hunting is pretty solitary and not really a whole lot of just like fun, where that hunt was just flat out fun. I enjoyed the hell out of it. Even when we were frustrated and not getting into elk, it was still just a blast.
Steve, man, how about for you?
Yeah, definitely hashtag man stuff. that became Trent's rallying call basically every time we got down or something. You know,
we're complaining.
Like, yeah. Or we're complaining. Yeah.
Talking about like a tree fell on his head once. Yeah.
Just, you know, sometimes, you know, like Trent put it, said it earlier. You know, it's just like we're so grateful and lucky to be where we are doing what we're doing.
Absolutely.
Just to sit back and just enjoy it, you know, and not be too down when the hunting's not great. So, you know, it's always good. You just got to keep that good attitude going and pushing forward. And then hunting strategy wise, I mean, we definitely learned a lot from these guys. They, you know, they are, they said they're products of their environment where, you know, they really had to get damn good at calling elk because when they do have an opportunity, they don't. Anyway, I don't know. I think we have a lot of elk where we're at, and you can be, as long as you're willing to work hard, which we are not afraid to do, you're going to kill an elk eventually or get your opportunity. Where there, you got to be really good at calling elk, and I think you got to work really hard. But when you do get an elk, you got to know what you're doing. And so for me personally, I'm going to put a reed in my mouth, you know, on January 1st and really start practicing my elk calls because I didn't realize the importance of the sounds that you make and how good your bugle sounds and stuff like that. Where we said for us, half the time I prefer not to even call. I just try to sneak in on something. So those two things for sure.
I've already lost track of who we have left to weigh
Cody.
In.
So you know what's interesting is I think everyone's got their own hunting style. And like Steve said before, it was product of our environment. And I think the coolest takeaway for me is coming together for like one common goal and putting different strategies or styles aside just to like make sure that, you know, it's embracing that and journey and the challenge and all that coming together and the culmination. Like we killed one elk out of the group of us with five tags, but it was like an unbelievably successful trip at the end. Like the camaraderie, absolutely. Like you said, the brotherhood, you know, hugging it out at the end. And like Trent said, the worst part's like when we split ways and see taillights going the other way, you know, knowing that it's going to be another year before we can share a campfire together, you know, in the elk woods. And that's the hardest part. So, yeah, I think that coming together for the common goal and embracing that experience.
All right, that's a wrap on this one. I hope you guys really enjoyed it. Up next, number 100, big giveaway. You're going to have a chance to win an Exo Mountain Gear pack. Gear from First Light and Tight Spot and Black Gold and so many others. Hope you guys tune in for that one. We are excited to share it with you here in about a week or so. So check that out. It's going to be good. Thank you guys as always so much for continuing to support and listen to the podcast. We really do appreciate it. You can always contact us by email to podcast@exomountaingear.com. We would love to hear from you, whether you have questions or feedback or any other suggestions to share. All right, until next time with episode 100, have a great week.